His talk tonight on the eve of the third debate could not be more timely. And after reading his book, I think you're going to find his insights extremely interesting. I look forward to joining you all in a very provocative discussion tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, here to speak about the intricacies of presidential campaigns, please welcome Dr. Samuel Popkin.
It's a pleasure to see former students willing to come back and listen again, and friends who haven't heard me speak before who are willing to take a chance on an evening of whatever I have to say. The real reason I wrote this book was to get the bad taste of the Gore campaign out of my mouth, to figure out how can somebody so often snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, and how can such bad things happen to such a promising person when everything looked there to be done right. And it was a dysfunctional, uncomfortable experience, the exact opposite of the perils of Pauline, lurch from danger to salvation over and over of the war room in 1999, or the more predictable, for good and bad, campaigns of Carter and McGovern. And I sat down to figure out what happened and why. And everything I thought about who I was going to get even with was wrong. Very quickly, I realized that you have to have standards if you judge campaigns. And you can't have standards without thinking about what's easy, what's hard, and why. And the first thing you realize when you do that is that there are three different campaigns, and the two candidates are never running the same campaign at the same time. There is always a challenger who's the candidate from the party out of power, and from the party that's in power, there's either an incumbent trying to keep power or a successor trying to retain power for a new candidate of the same party. And these three campaigns repeat over and over. The people are different, the issues may be different, but the similarities remain. Every challenger in some way is offering hope and change. The lines of Barack Obama, Jerry Brown, Gary Hart, Thomas Dewey, and even Richard Nixon in 1968 are more alike than will make people in either party comfortable. And every incumbent, whether they like it or not, is more of the same. The famous bulletin board in the war room in Little Rock that had the second line quoted around the world in 50 languages or more, "The economy's stupid," the first line was "change versus more of the same." And Barack Obama, President Obama, is starting to realize, whether he likes it or not, he's more of the same. He's no longer hope and change, the magic who can do it all. And every incumbent has a very hard time realizing, I can't do it the way I did last time. You still see people asking in the press, why can't he do it the way he did 4 years ago? What happened to 4 years ago? Well, you only get one first date. You only get one wedding night. You only get one first love bloom. After that, it's renewal of the vows, more of the same, and it's you're now the other person. You're now the one they're used to. And it's the new person who's saying, run away with me and it'll all be better. And the hardest thing I realized is the successor, because they're offering continuity and they've been a lapdog for 4 years defending somebody else's plans, and now they have to say, I actually have my own identity and I stand for things different from what I've been claiming to stand for. There's a reason they so seldom win. Not that Al Gore couldn't have, but there are reasons it was hard that he didn't get. Now, the first thing I realize once I understand there are three repeating campaigns is that this isn't chess. In chess, you start out with one color pieces, they have the other color, white and black, whatever. But everybody knows what everybody has. There's no bluffing. You don't start out with extra money so you can buy pawns. You don't start out with extra. Your bishop and their bishops do the same. It's all exactly the same pieces on the board. You know what the other person has. They can't take back any moves. This is more like poker. You know some of the moves, they're on. Some of the cards are on the table. Some of the cards are hidden. The two sides have different numbers of chips. And you don't know what card's going to turn up next. Will it be a video some old Jew took in Florida on their iPhone when you were talking about the 47% and, you know, a speech two-thirds about Iran and one-third about the ungrateful? Will it be you say macaca and suddenly the born-again Christian senator will be embarrassed because he never told people his mother was from a famous North African Jewish family? Will it be Bill Clinton saying what he said in Arkansas for 20 years, I never broke a state's drug laws, and not believing the national press would be smart enough to say, what about England? Because they never thought of that before, and you get caught with, I didn't inhale. It's very different every step of the way. And that makes me realize the notion that I had of a good strategy that you wouldn't have been in all this trouble, or a better team and you wouldn't have got all this trouble, is really nonsense, because there's no such thing as a strategy that lasts for a campaign. There's a great phrase from the Army that came up a lot at the beginning of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11 that I've never forgotten. I use a lot in the book talking about planning, and that's the military saying that the plan is nothing, but planning is everything. Until you've planned over and over and over and replanned and burnt your plan and scrapped it and started over, you don't know how to move quickly. And that's important because everything you do in a campaign is subject. Who knew this was going to be a week about Syria? Who knew of the 150 things going on one day, an attack in a small city where nobody had asked for extra security, the extra security requests were for Tripoli, not Benghazi, would explode. Who knows which archduke in which country, the day of the Panama Exposition and the opening of a World's Fair, might start World War I in a place nobody had ever heard of. It's always something. And that brings me to the part where the teamwork really matters. Of course the economy matters. Of course how the world is handled matters, but a huge amount of how it matters is how you adapt. When Mike Tyson was the greatest boxer in the world, before every fight, the reporters would say to him, well, this latest chump in the making says they've got a strategy that'll work against you. And Tyson's answer was always, everybody has a strategy till I punch him in the face. And that's part of what happens when you're a candidate. You know, when you're in the ring in the corner and you're like Rocky with Burgess Meredith in the smelling salts, or you're the quarterback and you're half groggy and you've got 15 seconds to know what you're going to do next, you have teamwork or you're gone. You can't suddenly debate what you're going to do and ask for more opinions. You need a drill. I said this in Kansas City one day, and the next day was the blow up in Syria. You're going to be getting off a plane one day, and your earpiece is going to say there's a nuclear cloud over X, one of 30 different. It could be India, Pakistan, Iran, Israel. It could be somewhere in the world. And you've got 300 reporters waiting 40 seconds away from you. You don't have time to say, what country is that? What continent? You know, you've got to know about what you're going to do, how you're going to fake it until you know more. You offer the prayer, whatever. But you have to be ready. And when you look at the campaigns, think of the president like a battleship and the challenger like a speedboat. The battleship does not change course quickly. You have to transmit a lot of orders. If you want to move the gigantic anchors, a lot to pick up speed. But you're very powerful, and you can make very big waves. If you're a challenger, you can theoretically move very quickly and make a lot of noise with that motor, but you can't really make as big waves. They're very different what you do. Now, when I studied challengers and looked at all the things that happen over time, some of you will remember, you will have been politically active in 1980 when it was probably the most uncomfortable pair of choices at the time Americans had to make, a not yet godlike Ronald Reagan that people were worried about, and a very disappointing Jimmy Carter, and everybody was looking for somebody to come and rescue us from this uncomfortable trade-off. And John Anderson, for a while, even looked like the second coming that would save everybody and was leading in polls in a few states. And Ellis Wiener, a script writer, wrote a piece in the New York Times, an op-ed, suggesting that the candidate we really needed for president was Yoda. You know, Yoda was the experienced virgin that we really needed. There's a reason I talk about the challengers as searching for the perfect experienced virgin. You want somebody who's pure and untainted, who's really going to do what you want without any of these messy compromises those phonies in Washington are making because they don't see how obvious the real solution is. And although you want somebody who's pure, you also want somebody who can handle the dirt, the mud, the slime, and all those bad things going on in Washington. And who could be better than Yoda? He's not only not part of Washington, he's from outside the solar system. He's skilled at lightsaber combat, and he's leading an order based on purity and honor. Now, there is no such thing, and as you go along, every challenger is basically saying, that man overpromised. He promised to do X, Y, and Z. There has never been, no president yet after 4 years has been able to say, I did even more than I promised. They all overpromise. Run away with me and it'll all be easy. I'll fix it, but no deficit, no unemployment, no wars, all peace. And now the glass is half full, and the challenger is saying, if it weren't for you, that glass could be full. It's your fault. And Ann Romney actually said it today as well as it could be said. She's in Tennessee, and she said to a crowd, try and find any independent or Democrat who voted for Barack Obama who's not disappointed that he didn't do all he said. You know, that's the standard line of any challenger. But that's not easy because they're asking you to take a leap of faith based on promises. And when they ask you to do that, a lot of it is based on, do you have faith in their character? The character of a candidate in America is a moral firewall. Every candidate has done something that doesn't play well in a bigger setting. Maybe as H.L. Mencken said, they discovered there were a lot of cannibals in their district, so they sent them missionaries to make them happy. Now you need the missionary vote too in another area, or you have to, you are the proudest vegan in the world, and now you've got to win in Nebraska. You know, whatever it is, when you go to a bigger arena, something you did, you opposed all that drilling in California, now you've got to win votes in Texas. Or whatever it is, if you're on the side of the Dolphins, now you need the tuna vote. And it gets very complicated when you move ahead. And if you have a character and a record people can believe in, that's your moral firewall. And Governor Romney had two strikes against him in America. Number one, he's a Mormon. As a Jew, I didn't know until 2008 that Mormons aren't considered Christians by an awful lot of people. If you teach at UC San Diego, you think of Mormons as slightly less lacking an edge, but some of your very best, hardest working students who are very interested in the world because they've done their mission work, like Governor Huntsman of Utah, and now they want to be professors who build on all they learned to care about when they were there. But for a lot of people, it's why it's a cult And what, I don't know why parting the Red Sea is a religion and rising from the dead is a religion and magic underwear is a cult. Sasha Issen, a reporter was interviewing me for a book, another book, The Victory Lab, and I asked Sasha Issenberg, well, if it's okay to part the Red Seas and get manna from heaven, if it's okay to rise from the dead, so what's different about the Mormons? And he says, oh, it's easy. You don't get grandfathered in for 2,000 years. But it's taken a while for that to be acceptable, and it's certainly more acceptable to be a Mormon than a Democrat or an African American for the people who are most distrustful at the beginning of Governor Romney. And the other one that was hard on him is the Pew polls. The Pew Center for the People in the Press show very clearly, if you're wealthy, you're considered smarter and harder working, but also more greedy and not quite as honest as everybody else. So you have to prove, even though I'm really wealthy and really talented, I care about you. What they used to say about John Conley was, he's the best man in Washington with power, but who'd trust him with it? And that's why a president is more than a CEO. Mitt Romney had a very hard time in 2008, and he told his friends, this is harder than being a CEO. And it is, because I discovered you, Peter Hart said to me, it'll all become clear to your readers if you talk about a day in the life of a candidate. And it was actually extraordinary to see on different days what was going on for the candidates. And the very simple fact that you're doing three things at once. You are the CEO of a rapidly expanding organization moving into 50 states and growing overnight. That's only one of your three jobs. You're also auditioning to be America's royal family, and you're out there showing the values that you'll bring to the White House and what kind of people you'll invite, who you're going to give honors to. When you're president, is it going to be a better Easter egg hunt or a better Passover Seder? Will there be gay marriages on the White House lawn? Or will there be nothing like that on the White House lawn? Will there be a baptism in the Potomac for your children? Who, you know, these things matter to a lot of people. Which values come out on top? It's like, you know, it's almost as important as the First Lady's arms or, you know, who makes the dresses. I can't believe how many people knew who made Michelle Obama's shoes, what color her nails were, and about the dress. But this is part of it. When you are the First Lady, when you are the first family, people care about these things. And the third thing is you're also a startup company offering a vision of the country, and that's particularly where things matter, that are you and your character and whether they can believe your vision. And until the first presidential debate, I was stunned by the lurching, inept quality of a fragmented Romney campaign. Because I have a lot of faith in Stuart Stevens, his campaign manager, who broke my heart by turning out to be a Republican because I'd read his travel books, which are brilliant. And then he wrote very, very intelligently about the Bush campaign of 2000. And with Stevens in charge, I expected things to go very well. But there were very, very clear signs of tension, power struggles, and bitterness in the campaign in an area that is obvious, a key to almost any campaign, and that is good coordination between the first family and the campaign. And some of you who follow things like junkies would know that at the time of the convention, Ann Romney made some very cutting public comments about Stuart Stevens that clearly displayed her irritation with him when she said, and he even tried to tell me what dress to wear. You know, I'm sure he did tell her something about what dress to wear. I am shocked that she brought it up with reporters, and it was clearly a way of letting everybody know I am really had it up to here with Stuart Stevens, who should know better because he survived Barbara Bush, who is, and I mean survived Barbara Bush. She is one very strong lady. I mean, people cringe around her. Now, President Obama's job now, and there were many things that Governor Romney said in the first debate that qualify as potentially untruthful. And I say that because it doesn't matter what I say or the fact checker says or any newspaper in the world says. You're not going to vote on your welfare. You're going to vote on your opinions about your welfare. And it depends on what you think is correct, not what is technically correct. You are entitled to your own facts, whether Patrick Moynihan likes it or not. Maybe you shouldn't be, but it depends. There are many things Governor Romney said that are subject to fact-checking, but there's one thing he said that is true and very misleading and more damaging to the president than the untruths. And I'm speaking by what people are calling them. I don't mean to define them as untruths definitively. That's your job. The thing he said that is true and threatening to President Obama is, I work well with Democrats. I play well with other people, and that's how I get things done. You have gridlock because you can't share with Republicans. You're the greedy, rigid ideologue. I am the flexible problem solver from Bain Capital. Now, that's not clear how that goes with, and on day one, I'm going to repeal Obamacare, and I'm going to do this. That's a more difficult question, but that's where the president comes in now. He has to get people to look before they leap. Before you take that leap of faith, look very carefully. And it comes down to, I'm safe, he's risky. Don't change horses in the middle of the stream, as FDR put it. But if you don't want people to change horses in the middle of the stream, you got to convince people you are in the middle, that you can make it to the other bank, that you know where you're going, and that you're good, you're the best rider available, and they might not get there sooner going back and renting another car. You know, you are going on the bridge instead of trying to go across the river. You have to convince people you know where you're going and you're getting there. And the president was satisfied, as every incumbent in the world is, until they get smacked with saying, look at the things he says that aren't true. Look at the bad things about him. The easiest thing in any campaign is, look at my good things, look at their bad things. The hardest thing for any campaign is to explain the bad things. The hardest thing for President Obama that they're worried about before the first debate and the president's bombing, was how do we explain to people why there's more hope in the second term? Even before Mitt Romney stuck it to them with, I can work with Democrats, you can't work with Republicans, they were worried about the possibility, because for people who don't understand a lot of the details, they think the problem is gridlock. We're not talking about the people who understand how old Anthony Kennedy is or that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is ill. We're not talking about people who really have a lot of information. We're talking about the people who very quickly, when the mud starts throwing, they just think the problem is the mud fight is the problem, not that there are principles behind it. And he was very good at saying Bin Laden is dead, General Motors is alive. That's two things where Mitt Romney is on the record is just wrong. But he hasn't been good at explaining to people why things will be better and why more can be done. So the campaign, like any incumbent with a divided government now, comes down to look at the things you will lose that you already got from me if he's elected. And number one is the DREAM Act. If Karl Rove and George W. Bush had succeeded with their goal of a moderate immigration reform, I don't think Barack Obama would be holding on to a narrow lead. I think he'd be scrambling to try and ever get a lead. Think of the difference if in every state the challenger was getting 30 to 35% of the Hispanic vote instead of 15 to 20% of the Hispanic vote. Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush got very substantial Hispanic votes as tolerant, open-minded people who Mediterranean death penalty-oriented Catholics thought of positively. And at the same time as that, and you know how well he painted the Republicans into the corner on immigration. When he did it, Senator Marco Rubio, who thought he was going to be the VP to help woo a few Hispanics with his Cuban background, would say that all he could say after that happened was, the White House never called us. No one ever reached out to me and told me this was on the way. In other words, you left me in standing, you know. But no Republican dared introduce anything on their own to get smacked down by the anti-immigration part of the party that has been threatening any kind of majority status for them. I mean, there's only one state with a sizable Hispanic population with a virulently anti-Hispanic Republican elite, and that's Arizona. And California, Florida, Texas, they're desperate at the elite level to get this settled. And the other thing is gay marriage. You know, among all of the Hispanic voters in Florida, well over a million counting Hispanic and Cuban together, the margin of Barack Obama in 2008 was 190,000 votes. His margin among gay voters in Florida was 280,000. You want to know why in New York State the wealthy, moderate on social issues Republicans were paying a fortune to get the Republicans in the state legislature to go for gay marriage? To get that off the table in New York State. It's a problem, though, when the grassroots don't like all these stinky compromises. You know, it's what looks like a principled stand on gay marriage to Wall Street looks like selling out God to Gomorrah and Sodom to others. And that's a problem. The Republican Party right now is going through what the Democrats went through in the 70s when you knock off senators. And the president is also the commander in chief. In contrast, I'm almost to my last 3 minutes. I'm being told to wind up. I managed to get it down almost as short as it's supposed to. The president, think of about his two trips to Afghanistan if you want to really see the difference between the challenger and the commander in chief. 2008, you see him in Afghanistan shooting three-pointers and signing autographs. This time, he goes to Afghanistan, and he commemorates shooting bin Laden, and he signs a treaty. That's the difference. A president can go to China. That's a presidential move. A president can veto things. And the one weakness of the White House, and I know people like Axelrod agree on this, is the fact that there is no Obama veto because he wanted to be Mr. Moderator between, you know, half of you and half of you and we'll all compromise. There's a line that haunts me as a Democrat from Henry Kissinger where Henry says, moderation without an alternative is no virtue. But how do you show there's an alternative if you haven't done anything? If you're going to speak softly, how do you let people know you're carrying the veto stick, the big stick of Teddy Roosevelt? And that's been a problem so far. He did very well with his gay marriage pronouncement. It turned out to be brilliantly lucky timing nobody could be sure of. Everybody had knots in their stomach. Will there be an explosion in North Carolina because he didn't do it or because he did? And in fact, it turned out overdue. It could have been done any time, but who knew? And contraception has given him help. But he still has to do an incredibly difficult job now, and he has to do it in the second debate, and that is explain why the second term is going to get better. And it's harder now because it's a town hall, and you don't know what the questions are, and you can't stick it back and forth to the other candidate like looking without looking like a streak fighter and losing the presidential mojo. All presidential candidates have a bad first debate. I learned that playing Jimmy Carter, and the most sort of shocking for me when I wrote that part of the book about I'd look back at the debate tapes that I inherited, and it's a little embarrassing. It's a little bit like the emperor's new clothes when you realize the president thinks they know everything going on in the world, and they think people are being frank with them. And nobody's frank with anybody. They all want something. Nobody is. Joe the plumber would say, "Your Honor, Mr. President." Now, nobody really sticks it to you one-to-one to your face. They may say vicious things about you in the press. They, in the South, people hung Clint Eastwood's chair from a tree. But they don't do that to you in person. You're not used to this in person. And he had an unusually bad time. He obviously evaded more debate practice than most incumbents get away with. They all try to evade and hide. When I debated President Carter at Camp David, after 11 minutes, he turned red and said, "Isn't that enough?" And it took three sessions before he could give me a presidential stare instead of just hoping the Secret Service would kneecap me. And at the same time, Governor Romney was brilliantly prepared. And you know, I make a point in the book. Charisma is the most overrated nonsense in the world. Charisma is not an inherent trait of any person. Remember when Barack Obama was charismatic? Wasn't so charismatic a week ago. Remember when Mitt Romney was adult? Look at people looking at him out on the stump now. Charisma is about whether or not you are making people hopeful. When you offer people hope, then you're charismatic. When Barack Obama gives people the hope that he'll get more done, he can be charismatic again. Now, he has to figure that out now, and that's the challenge of the next two debates, this stunning situation. I don't think anybody in the world expected Mitt Romney to do something now after doing nothing between his convention and the first debate. I wrote with James Fallows on the Atlantic website that it was a very smart, not a very bold choice to pick Paul Ryan. I said, now you've got Ryan inside the tent pissing out instead of outside the tent pissing in. And now you've got Paul Ryan's number one goal in life is power now, not purity, so you can have power later. Now Paul Ryan will do anything to get power now, including denouncing whatever he said in his old budget, but they waited until the debate to say, that's not what I stand for. I mean, we have a release 3.0, and the president has to find a way to deal with which Romney is really running, and does the new Romney have numbers that make sense? The fact that he's different now than what he was earlier, well, Bill Clinton did that all the time and got elected as Slick Willie, as the Republicans call them. So it's not true you can't be a broken field, evasive runner and get reelected. It's up to the incumbent to prove that you can't do what you promised. Now, I better stop now because I know I can see all the question cards being collected. Thank you.
Thanks very much. First question is about the debates, and do undecideds really tune in at this late date to the debates to select their choice, and do decideds switch their votes based on the debates?
Some decideds switch when they see new choices they didn't know existed. The surprise after debate one was a few people who were decided did switch. The real undecideds the two campaigns are worried about do not have enough political knowledge, sophistication, or interest to follow all the way, but they do hear what survives that can't be ripped apart when it gets into the simpler press later. So the debates matter for the conversations they start, not for the what you do to the judges on the spot.
Okay. How much, to what extent should a candidate's likability affect a voter decision?
Should or does? I don't think likability should matter, but everybody cares whether you like them because you find it harder to believe a person you don't like is trustworthy. If you don't like somebody, you're smelling a rat, and it can be very hard. I mean, you don't have to like your the person who changes the tires on your car, but it's hard not to want to like the brain surgeon who's going to operate on your child. And it's hard not to want to like the person if you're going to have heart surgery or deliver a baby.
And to what extent, the follow-on question is it most indicative of future performance as president, likability?
No. It's one of those things we care about. Whether it matters, I mean, it matters, yes, because it cares, but it doesn't predict whether you'll like them in 4 years. How many people married their first date ever? Yeah. Or their prom date?
So a very specific question. If you were advising President Obama, what single advice would you give him to win Ohio?
I think the advice for Ohio is to remind people how many jobs outside the auto companies were saved when he saved the auto companies, and why Romney thought it was not going to work, because he didn't trust the people in the industry. There's a famous phrase, we envy people above us and scorn the people below us. Well, there has to be a way for the president to remind people, Romney's not telling you the details because he thinks you're too dumb to notice. I would remind people that the Romney and Ryan said, well, I can't explain it. I only have a month before the election. There's something, you know, you're insulting the intelligence of people who don't like to have their intelligence insulted, even if they are not intelligent.
You have described in your book pandering as inevitable, but you've also said that candidates have to limit themselves to principled pandering. Could you elaborate on that and also perhaps add what strategy you might have recommended?
Okay, pandering is necessary because you have to make promises to people, but you can't promise one group a whole loaf and then promise another group the same loaf and they might not notice, because you never know when the video will come out from Florida or the people in northern Illinois will find out what you said in southern Illinois has happened often or something of that form. And by principled pandering, I mean showing enough commitment without promising to go all the way on the first date. There's a way when Ronald Reagan was asked to prove that he wasn't just a Hollywood man with Jewish and gay friends who'd been divorced, the evangelicals stuck in. He lost the evangelical vote badly in 76 to the more conventional Gerry Ford. And remember, Ronald Reagan had once been a liberal Democrat who the California Democratic Party wouldn't run for Congress because he was too far to the left in 52. He's one of the most fascinating people in the book, and writing about what an extraordinarily talented person he was. He got more of what he wanted than most of my candidates get of what they wanted. When Reagan was asked in a big showdown, do you believe the Bible is the literal word of God? Now, if that were Mitt Romney, he would have said, of course. Ronald Reagan said, over the centuries, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people have bought that book. Who could doubt its divine inspiration? When George W. Bush was secretly being taped in 1999 and was asked, now I can deliver by a real heavy-duty evangelical with an enormous rabble-rousing get-out-the-vote talent, said to him, I can do this for you. All you got, you know, and let me just get this straight. You have promised you'll never hire any gays and you'll fire all the gays in the government you can. And W, not knowing he was being secretly taped, said, I never promised I wouldn't hire gays, and I never promised I would fire gays. I've been a sinner. It's not up to me to decide what other sinners should be punished. Now, that's not going very far, but it's doing just enough to say, I understand you. I can't go that far. But he's giving a biblical reason. You know, it's a lot better than saying, of course, you know, and it's knowing how far to go that way. Clinton refused to promise never to raise taxes because, very simply, he said, it's irresponsible to make a promise when you don't know what the future is going to hold.
You have used the term, I think, obsessive bipartisan disorder.
That's, and, by the way, it's not my phrase. It's a psychoanalyst who said that about Obama.
Well, that's what
I quoted. It's a great phrase.
So do you see any hope for more bipartisanship in the next 4 years?
Yes, because second terms, when a president, Bill Clinton got more, Ronald Reagan got more, the minute it breaks for a lot of people, and the Civil War in the Republican Party is very well underway already. Lindsey Graham has signaled that he's ready to talk about taxes as well as cuts. Jeb Bush fired the best line of the year at Grover Norquist when he said, "I don't outsource my principles to anybody," about the pledge to never, ever, 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 ever close a loophole or raise a tax. I mean, and Jeb Bush also took on immigration and talked about how Ronald Reagan would be run out of this party along with his father. So the movement is starting to do something about the Tea Party. And there's also a big civil war on the other side. Because Mitt Romney is no Walter Mondale, when Walter Mondale lost, I realized in 1992 that's how Bill Clinton could win, because Walter Mondale is a 100% honorable, decent, respectable man. Nobody could say it was the messenger, not the message. No matter what happened, whether Mitt Romney wins or loses, there'll be a civil war, and people will say it would have never been close if he hadn't been so moderate. Or he lost because he used to be a moderate.
I want to ask, can you provide your analysis of the progress of the 2012 presidential election to date? Can you describe what has been the biggest shortcoming of each campaign?
The biggest shortcoming of the Romney campaign is an inability to create any distance between himself and the extremes in his primary. You know, lurching from one overpromise to another when all he had to do to hold on to the vote was being enough of a conservative to win, as opposed to people who couldn't possibly win. And the biggest problem of President Obama was not facing the fact he was going to have to say why it'll work better in the next 4 years, as opposed to it's better than they say it is. You know, he's been saying, without me, that glass wouldn't be half full, it'd be empty. I saved you from the cliff. Okay, fine. Winston Churchill saved England, and they sent him off the paint after World War II. They said, okay, the war is over, and now we want a social president. Obama has to explain why the best is coming.
Another question is, given the public concern about recent Supreme Court rulings on corporate privileges, why hasn't the potential nomination of 1 to 4 Supreme Court justices not a Democratic campaign issue?
Why aren't the candidates talking about the Supreme Court? Because if you care about that issue, you already know about that issue, and there's no need to waste money on it. Many people who are undecided don't understand it, and many people who are undecided are better off not knowing. The Democrats or the Republicans don't want them to think about it. Obama doesn't want to make promises now that might hurt him in Ohio and rural areas. And Romney certainly doesn't want to go any farther. He already said once Scalia was his favorite judge. That I don't think was a good idea. Maybe it was Ryan. One of the two of them, and I apologize. Which one was it?
Ryan.
Ryan said, well, my model is Scalia. He's not going to say that again, I bet.
Should we limit the amount of money spent on campaigns? Let me leave it with that.
Yeah, good luck on that. You can't limit the money on campaigns until the Supreme Court overturns Buckley versus Vallejo, which says you can spend all of your own money you want. Because if you limit every other kind of money, you're only going to have, you know, the Koch brothers running their own campaign against somebody. The biggest problem now is with this money not even going to the candidates, but going to every kind of group where it gets hidden and buried. But I'll say this might be the year the Republicans are sorry about Citizens United. Sheldon Adelson will have to give more than $100 million to Governor Romney to make up for the $20 million he gave Newt Gingrich to smear Mitt Romney in the primaries. And this is the era the Republicans, even remember, were complaining madly about Fox News. Ed Rollins pointed out early on, he said, Michelle Bachmann goes on Fox News, she says something outrageous, raises $2 million, and doesn't think she ever has to get serious. And think of all the trouble the Michelle Bachmanns and Newt Gingriches of the world with all this money made for the nominee. If there weren't super PACs, Santorum, Gingrich, and Bachmann might have never gotten out of New Hampshire.
Interesting. You talked about a potential civil war in the Republican Party. Also have a question. Is it possible for moderates to recapture the Republican Party?
It'll be a different kind of moderates than the old days, but something is going to happen. And certainly there's huge pressure for moderation on immigration, gay marriage, and some tax issues, but not all. And it's going to take more than one cycle, but I'll make one very strong prediction. The future of the Republican Party will be carved up by governors who need to run states and are free of these identities of people in Washington. The shock to me was how hard it is for a president, because there's people in his party and the other party who are fighting to protect their identity. Jimmy Carter was elected at a time when there was never going to be big spending programs again. The day of the free money was over. He was the first, no free lunch president. He wasn't very good at explaining that to the party, but people like Ted Kennedy had built their whole career on spending, not on job creating or business environments. And Ted Kennedy wasn't going to say, I'm yesterday's news, any more than Robert Taft was with Dewey.
How unusual is it for a foreign prime minister to intrude into U.S. presidential elections?
It's less unusual than we might think. This is the most public of its kind. Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chiang Kai-shek did a lot of manipulating with Richard Nixon. There were games being played with Johnson. But this is by far the most open example. It's been part of the Republican strategy, by the way, since the year 2000. And it's a very smart strategy to divide Jewish money in politics. Get the Orthodox Jews who care about Israel first to really, really donate heavily and deprive the Democrats of a major funding source. And it's obviously bearing some fruit. It's not illegal.
This is one of the few questions about...
I'm not defending it. I'm just saying, I wish it were illegal. I mean, don't look at me like that.
This is one of the few questions about a past election. Although Senator McGovern was the most righteous war hero, and he lost horribly. Why?
Because I didn't understand how important it was at the time. I was doing polling and analysis for Senator McGovern. I didn't understand that Richard Nixon won the election the day he went to China, because that made peace with honor 100% credible. And George McGovern's peace tomorrow as opposed to peace with honor was profoundly upsetting at the time to the American people. And then, of course, it was the promise of his to back Thomas Eagleton 1,000%. That was a problem. There was a competence issue.
Why do you think Obama has not run against the Republican Congress?
Because that makes him look impotent. The question is, why do you not run against the Republican Congress? Because you're going to say, if you want to get anything done, either change the Congress or change the president, and that's not the way to do it. That's what Romney is saying now. I can work with anybody, so get rid of him. Boards fire a CEO they love if the company rebels and the CEO can't quell the rebellion.
The president can't possibly accomplish anything legislatively in a second term with a Republican House and certainly no filibuster-proof Senate. What can he promise for a second term and still have credibility?
He actually can promise things. He can promise anything, anytime. And he actually has clout because what's called Taxageddon. The Republicans were so sure they could come up with a budget deal, remember, when they kiboshed Simpson-Bowles, they agreed, we'll sign the debt ceiling, and if we don't come up with a deal, there'll be a gigantic decimating cut in defense and a painful, severe cut to other spending. Now, that's not going to happen, probably, but he's got a lot of leverage there if he wants to use it instead of being the moderate mediator between two sides. He has to be the leader of a side, which he's now doing.
You've talked about the difficulty of an incumbent of coordinating between his White House team, his campaign team, and his family and friends. How does President Obama do this, and how effective is his organization?
It was very effective in last time. All incumbents have much more trouble. You don't have a Secretary of State wannabe in the basement that you say, do what I tell you. You've got somebody protecting their turf, Hillary Clinton, who's doing a very good job, or you've got the whole government, and you can't possibly coordinate them when one of them goes out and says they've been for gay marriage all along, not realizing they're not supposed to say anything. I mean, you can't get that coordination. And I smelled trouble very early on when they decided to keep the campaign headquarters in Chicago. And a month or two ago, they announced everybody in the Washington part of the team was spending a day a week in Chicago now to smooth things. It's been a real problem that Axelrod's in Chicago with the analytics people and the press and a lot of the people, and there's a White House team. And you saw they even did the thing of having two press secretaries on the plane, one for the campaign and one for the government.
What do you think will happen to Hillary Clinton's career? Do you think she'll run in 2016?
When I was talking about what happened to President Bush in 92 in a case study of from his point of view of that election, I was hit by a quote from Mike Piazza, the Dodgers catcher who was a baseball all-star 12 times and is guaranteed a future Hall of Fame place. And the reporter was interviewing him about his vineyards. And the reporter said, do you still have the desire to play? Because he looks so fit and trim and healthy. And he said, you never lose the desire to play, but you lose the desire to prepare to play. You know, does she really want to go through Iowa for 7 months? I don't know. I mean, that it's really, you know, do you realize what the hours are? Do you realize how much flesh pressing and trouble? Now, it certainly is one of the more stimulating, adrenaline-loading, alpha male and female exciting things you can do. But I don't know. She certainly has what it takes. You know, from the day after the Iowa primary on, she out-campaigned and outsmarted President Obama, but she'd started in such a hole by being uncomfortable, trusting her judgment, and delegating too much. But from the day after Iowa on, she was, on average, better at almost everything than the president. But that's not enough. I mean, does she want to spend a year and a half doing this? I don't know.
There are a couple of questions relating to the press, the media. Could you talk a bit about the role of the media in terms of the campaigns and the election, and also about the role of polls?
There's always new media. One of the things I tried to stress in my writing is there's never a newest thing that is a total game change because the boundary changes. And the hard thing for candidates is not what is Facebook or the cell phone or the CB radio or television do. It's understanding how the boundaries change between what's public and what's private, and every time you have a media change, there's a new audience that wants deep, deep detail, and another audience that wants it simple. When Oprah starts interviewing you, you can do simple things for audiences that could never follow the Lehr NewsHour. When Bloomberg comes along or MSNBC, you also have to be able to go really deep with Rachel Maddow or as the smartest of the New York Times conservative columnists, Ross Douthat, put it, if you can't go on Jon Stewart, you're not qualified to be president. And he didn't mean that you should be Jon Stewart's politics, but if you can't talk about what you stand for with Jon Stewart, you're not qualified.
What do you think the impact is going to be of the selection of Paul Ryan as the vice presidential candidate?
Well, I thought more would be done with Ryan, and it certainly hasn't changed Wisconsin very much. And on that, Nate Silver at the New York Times, the 538.com person, was very good estimating how much of a bump for how long you get in the vice president's state has been. The effect of Ryan was more to quiet the right from going crazy. If it hadn't been with Ryan on the ticket, I think the right would have gone crazy at the first debate when Mitt Romney said, I'm not a conservative. He didn't say that, but he acted like he wasn't.
And now the final question is, who's going to win the election?
I was willing early on to bet a dinner for four at any restaurant in the country on the president. I'm not ready to raise the bet, and I'm willing to stay with the bet. But I'm not going to raise it to a trip for four, you know, meal for four at any city in the world where I pay for the airfare or you pay for the airfare.
On that note, I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Popkin. Appreciate your excellent talk and discussion.